And good evening. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network. Each week, we are joined by live guests talking about one of mankind's most enduring mysteries, and that is the mystery of unidentified flying objects. Tonight's show is being brought to you by the world's premier magazine on the subject, one that has been published since 1986, and it is the place where everyone goes when they want to find out what's really happening. The magazine UFO, and you can find out more about it by listening to our show tonight. And if you would like to contact us at UFO Magazine, make sure you get a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper and get ready to take down some important information during the show. Well, this week we're going to be talking to someone that has been very much involved in bringing the subject of unidentified flying objects to public perception. The individual that's joining me tonight, my guest, and a gentleman that I've known since 1988, is Tracy Torme. And if you don't know who Tracy is, and if you haven't been watching television, let me give you a very brief rundown. For a number of years, he was a writer on none other than Saturday Night Live. He was on the staff and one of the executive story editors on Star Trek: The Next Generation. Last spring, my guest for one of several appearances here on UFOs Tonight was none other than Bud Hopkins, and his book Intruders was taken to the small screen on television, and it was written by none other than Tracy. And now a story that has been around in the UFO field for many, many years, a story that encompasses, well, it encompasses everything from what was suspected to be murder to UFOs, possible aliens, an individual that was gone for almost a week and then almost miraculously reappeared, and the story hasn't died down yet. And the person that is now bringing it to the screen, because it is premiering on March the 12th, the name of the movie, incidentally, Fire in the Sky, the Travis Walton story, is none other than my guest this evening, Tracy Torme. And good evening, Tracy. It's a pleasure having you here.
Hey, Don. I'm glad to be here.
Tracy, we're going to be on here from coast to coast, and I know that many people that tune into this program each week are mystified, some frightened, and almost universally fascinated by this subject. And of course, it's, I'm sure, a question that you've been asked many, many times. But someone that has been as successful as you have in the Hollywood entertainment business, usually they're not associated with UFOs, but yet your name has been in this field for years. As a matter of fact, I heard about you when I first entered this field full-time way back in 87, 88. What caused this?
Well, that's a good question, Don. I think I got to move away from it a little bit in the future because all this stuff is sort of coming out around the same time, so it does seem like I'm almost obsessed with this. But actually, I just felt when I first started investigating the subject just on my own that there were some great stories that needed to be told. I wasn't real thrilled with Close Encounters. I think it's a good movie, but I think it was not all that accurate, and so I sort of was interested in the crash stories, the Roswell story, the abduction stuff from an early stage, and I just feel there are good stories to be told, and this is sort of my time to do it, and then I guess I'll move on to some other things.
Well, how did you happen to become as fascinated by the Travis Walton account as what you have? I know a number of years ago, I read one of your original screenplays on this feature film from ICM that was at UFO Magazine, so this is not something new with you. You've been actually working on this for years, haven't you?
Yeah, actually, that's true. I wrote the first script in 1986. I think Vicki and I were friends, and she read one of the first drafts that I did. And, so I've been at this for almost 7 years, and it's been a long time coming to get this film off the ground.
Well, now, for someone from your position, and although you've had a fascination with this subject, of course, there are many other things that you are involved in. What is your overall take? Do you believe that there is, in fact, a mystery here, Tracy?
Don, absolutely. I think there is a real mystery here. I think it's the greatest mystery of the 20th century. I think it's the most misunderstood mystery of the 20th century. I think the problem now is that if you're a sort of logical believer or skeptical believer, as I try to think that I am, and I think that you are as well, you sort of get boxed in on both sides, because on one side you have the Phil Klass type of people who take the attitude of it can't be, therefore it isn't. So they have no interest in honest skepticism. They basically just go out to ridicule and to tear stories down and then try to fit the facts that they choose into their own theories. But then on the other side, you have the sort of increasingly wild believers that I think believe way too much and that fall for a lot of disinformation. And so it becomes harder and harder to separate the wheat from the chaff, I think, in the field. And you guys do a great job of that, and it's got to be kind of nightmarish sometimes to even be confronted with it.
Well, you're absolutely correct, and I appreciate that compliment. My guest this evening is screenwriter Tracy Torme, and he is the co-producer of the new feature-length film coming out, premiering on March the 12th, Fire in the Sky, the Travis Walton story. If you'd like to speak to Tracy this evening and you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes, that's toll-free. Tracy, let me ask you something. Having watched the Intruder miniseries last year, and I think we both know that the miniseries did not have a whole lot in common with the Hopkins book other than the general overall mystery of abductions, I've noticed that in this particular work, and from what I have heard from some people that have been able to preview the new film coming out, that the UFO investigators were put in, I guess the best way to say this is a pretty harsh light. In other words, kind of a wackoid type individual that was buzzing around the periphery of this subject. Is there a reason for that?
Well, actually, that's a good question, too, because that character was not even in my script. Very shortly before we started shooting, the director had watched a bunch of David Lynch films recently just by chance, and he said, you know, we should put a touch of David Lynch into this movie. And he came up with the concept of this sort of nosy and sort of overly aggressive investigator, and he initially wrote the scene, and then I went in and sort of polished it and rewrote it. But no, it's absolutely not supposed to represent anyone or any group, but I would say that in, you know, what I did use in both pieces, I do think there's a fringe element in ufology that is kind of wacky, you know, and it'd be much easier for me to just sort of, you know, put people up there who are staid, scientific, you know, people that look like Alan Hynek and that investigate this stuff. But I just felt the character in Intruders was a little more lively to initially bring him off as kind of a little bit out there, but eventually you see he's actually a credible college professor and he's actually onto something real. So I think that character was misunderstood. And I think this one is highly misunderstood because people want to personify it. You know, they want to think that I'm saying this is one of the Lorenzans or this is somebody that was involved with the case. I love the Lorenzans. I thought they were fantastic, and I miss them. So,
You, of course, are speaking of Jim and Coral Lorenzen, who were actually the very first organization, private civilian organization, to investigate this phenomenon starting back in the 1950s. And Jim, I believe, passed away in 1981 or 82, and Coral just passed away several years ago.
Yeah, they did tremendous work on this case, you know, and so did a lot of people. So, no, if anyone sees that character and comes away, you know, saying, oh, no, look what they're saying about ufologists, that's in their imagination because, honestly, this character was thrown in just to add sort of a quirky touch to the film. It is not meant to represent ufologists across the board or anything like that.
Well, you know, and I know that this phenomenon sometimes seems to be becoming even larger than would be believed.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I just got a great deal of information from a flap or a wave that's happening right now in Alabama. There have been right now over 30 confirmed cattle mutilations. People have cited black helicopters flying well below the FAA specified limit. There have been, in fact, UFOs sighted down there. And it's obvious that the municipal authorities, the state authorities, and the federal authorities, at least on the surface, have no interest
right.
in investigating this phenomenon. So it basically falls down on the civilian
right.
ufologists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, Tracy, you're absolutely correct when you say that there's a real fringe element out there.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the element that's much more stable?
Well, I have tremendous respect for those people because I think that they're on to something that most of the world is asleep at the wheel about. I mean, just from that at the beginning, I respect anybody who believes there's a real phenomena and who goes into this with a skeptical eye and investigates because they are ahead of their time. They're ahead of the crowd. They're ahead of the pack. They're separated from the rest of the sort of sheep that we have in society, especially in the scientific community, who just have such closed minds that they refuse to even look at the evidence. So, to me, those people are heroes in a lot of ways because they're on to the mystery and they don't care whether people ridicule them or not. They know better, you know, and I respect them completely.
Okay, let me take a real quick break, and when we come back, let's start talking about Fire in the Sky. I'm fascinated to hear what you have to say about it.
Terrific.
Okay. And tell them you heard about it here on UFOs Tonight. And my guest this evening, Tracy Torme, screenwriter and co-producer of the new feature-length film, Fire in the Sky. It's going to be opening nationwide on Friday, March the 12th. And Tracy is joining me here this evening, and if you would like to speak to him or myself, and you're in the 213-310 or 818 area codes, we have Dan on from Victorville. Good evening, Dan.
Well, how you doing, Don Ecker?
Just fine. We have Tracy Torme here on the line. Did you have a question for our guest?
Well, you know, I've got a couple questions and a couple of comments. First off, let me throw all the great kudos out that I can all the way around. Don, great show, great magazine.
Well, thank you.
Intruders was an excellent portrayal of the abduction phenomenon.
Thank you.
Now we get to the negative side of the force.
Okay.
I did have the pleasure of seeing a screening of Fire in the Sky. I also read the articles in the MUFON Journal this month, including the letter in the MUFON forum from you.
Right.
And it seems you felt a need to explain some of the fictionalization that took place in Fire in the Sky.
That's right.
I've got to tell you that I was a little disappointed when I saw the piece.
What was your disappointment, Dan?
Well, I didn't see a resemblance to the Travis Walton case in any way other than the fact that the man was gone 5 days and there was a red glow in the sky.
So the scenes in the truck and the scenes with the law enforcement and the town and all of that stuff just came from whole cloth?
Well, why did you find a need to fictionalize the gentlemen that were with Mr. Walton?
Well, first, I'd appreciate, though, if you'd answer that question.
What was that, sir?
You're saying that the scenes in the truck, the scenes with about the incident, the scenes about the law enforcement investigation, the interpersonal relationships between Travis and the other people, the romance he was involved in, and the way the town reacted to him, you're saying none of that resembled anything that was in the real story.
Let me be kind in that sense. Yes, I would say that I have no argument with that because that isn't the part of the Travis Walton case that really interests me.
Okay, let me answer that. That is the part that interests me.
Uh-huh.
So that to me is what the film is entirely about. To me, the fact that the film has been marketed as a UFO film is being done, you know, by Paramount, and I understand the reasons for that. The heart of this film is about all the things that I just named, which are very, very close to the truth.
What are you saying, Tracy, that you see this more as a story about interpersonal relationships?
Absolutely. And I'll say something else that I'd just like to quickly comment on because I had a feeling this might come up. We did do some screenings for the foreign press and people from CNN, NTV, BBC, VH1, New York Times, Time Warner, all of these people. There were a number of ufologists or a small amount of people from MUFON LA there as well. What's happened since then to me is kind of fascinating because all the people from the non-UFO world were coming up and congratulating us and saying they've never seen a film like this.
Yes.
They were saying that this, for the first time, they will take the subject of UFOs seriously because they've never believed in it before, but after seeing this film and the way the evidence is presented and speaking to Travis Walton, they now will look into it. They now will take it seriously. They will not laugh the next time a case like this comes out. So you had all of these reactions uniformly on one side, and then on the other side, there were a small group of people who've already gotten on the rumor mill around the country, because I've been hearing this stuff from Canada and Florida and other places, who are outraged that we didn't do a documentary.
Well, I'm not quite outraged.
I'm not putting you in that category. I apologize, but I'm just saying that's what I'm hearing from the people in the UFO circles is, why is there any fiction?
Wait a minute, gentlemen. Let me ask a question here. Tracy, one of the questions that I do have, now I have not yet seen the film, and hopefully if everything goes according to plan, I'll be seeing it Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the questions I do have, because several people did call us at the office at UFO and ask us, why were the alleged entities that picked up Walton, the alien entities, fictionalized?
Okay.
Now, as we both know, and I'm very familiar with Travis's case, one of the really strange things about that case were that the at least some of the people on board this alleged craft were in fact very humanoid, very human looking, and I found that absolutely fascinating. And you know, it can't hurt that it's a true part of the case, at least as told by Walton.
Okay.
But yet this was changed.
Here's the answer to that. It's really a pretty simple answer. All of that stuff was in all of my scripts, and when we sold the script, the case happened exactly like Travis said it, with the two kinds of humanoids him running down the hallway, the star room, everything that everyone's familiar with was in the film. Intruders ran while we were in pre-production. The people at Paramount said, wait a minute, on this $20 million check we're giving you, we now have done some investigating, and we've discovered that what Travis saw in 1975 may have been really interesting then, and it may be interesting to a handful of ufologists now, but on a larger scale, we've been seeing this now in Communion, in Intruders, in Betty and Barney Hill, on Nikon commercials, on light beer commercials. They said, we don't want to do it again. We don't want to see a guy lying on a table, waking up with little guys with big eyes standing over him, et cetera, et cetera.
I certainly understand their fears when it comes to the artistic approach to it.
But let me just say one thing further. We worked with Travis and with ILM to very carefully come up with a sequence that was a nightmare. Basically, the idea of the scene is let's create a nightmare that's different than Travis's nightmare, but that equates Travis's nightmare, and let's take things from other abduction cases and do it. Now, I think you would admit, Dan, that the scene's very powerful. It's so powerful some people can't watch it, and I understand that. But Travis Walton said that it completely, completely equivocates what happened to him in emotion, in impact, and in the feeling he got watching the scene. He said he felt like he was reliving what happened to him, even though the details were different.
I'll tell you what my fears are, and this is from the point of view of a serious researcher rather than some of the lunatic fringe that we know inhabits this field.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with abduction cases and you're dealing with hypnotherapy, you can get to a factor that is called confabulation. And as nightmarish as that scene is, and of course my only concerns are for the people in the UFO field. I realize your concerns are much broader than that. But mine are for the people in the UFO field. The degree of confabulation that may come up after Fire in the Sky is released will possibly be phenomenal. And these are the fringe elements that have been in abductions and do I need to explain confabulation? To you, I don't think so, but Don, to your audience, it's up to you. They may come up with stories that are vastly different than the similar stories that we've been studying for years. The similarity itself is what makes it so interesting. Another factor, to be very honest with you, was the portrayal of the UFO researchers. I have never seen researchers with less empathy than the ones that you portrayed.
Then you didn't meet William Spalding when he was up there investigating the case.
A real jerk, huh?
And those UFO investigators you're mentioning are on the screen for, what, about 2 minutes of the movie?
I understand.
So here's my point, because this does kind of irk me, and I'm not saying this to you directly, because you sound like a very nice guy and a very credible guy, but already in a day or two since the screening, people have gotten on computer networks and on the phone and stuff and have said things similar to what you said when you first came on the line, which was, there's nothing in this movie that resembles any of the truth except for the red glow or whatever. And I quickly said to you, wait a minute. 90% of this movie is extremely close to the truth, and that's the part that is what the movie's all about, and you basically agreed to that.
Absolutely.
So then what it comes down to is, if people are going to see this movie for an 8-minute special effects sequence and a 2-minute ufological sequence, which they feel will fit into their reality or what they think should be promoted on the screen, then I would say don't go see the movie, because that's not what this movie is about. And I cannot make a movie that concerns myself with whether ufologists will be pleased with what they're seeing. I have to make a dramatic film, and at the same time, I have to be truthful to Travis and the people that this really happened to. And the acid test on this is, people that are not interested in UFOs are now interested in UFOs, that's A, and B, Travis and the people involved are thrilled with the film and feel the film is very accurate.
I certainly understand your position. Like I say, my only fears, of course, are those people that have never been interested in ufology, but they see, as quickly as it goes by, they see researchers as idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And we know there's idiots everywhere. Of course there are.
But and guys, I've got to cut you both off here. Let me put you on hold. I've got to take a quick break, and when we come back, you can continue. I have some other people also holding, Dan, so we're going to have to wind this up. And for you folks that are out there that are trying to get through, I have a couple of open lines now. If you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes, you and we are back to our guests. Go ahead, guys. We're going to have to wrap this up because we have some other calls.
Well, in that case, let me just say once again that I do applaud you, Mr. Torme, for the work you did on Intruders. I think that the similarities that were shown in that piece, and I do notice it's in video store release now.
That's true.
And it is excellent.
But Dan, if you took away the UFO sequence, do you think we have a good movie?
On which? Fire in the Sky?
Yes.
I think the UFO sequence is excellent if it were more akin to what we're researching.
So I'm saying if that sequence were out of the movie,
you have a
good
think
movie. The rest of the movie works.
It's a good movie.
Thank you.
Okay.
I thought you felt that way. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Okay, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Take care of yourself.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And we have Bert in Burbank. Good evening, Bert.
Hello there. This is the fringe element checking in.
Well, each week, Bert checks in.
Yeah. Tracy, I also had the privilege of seeing the screening a number of days ago, and on the other side of what Dan is saying, I thought it was incredibly well shot, extremely well acted, certainly beautifully written, and the direction was terrific. It's going to be a movie that the common man, the guy who is not generally interested in UFOs, is going to at least hear about, and people are going to say, go see this thing.
I hope so, Bert.
Yeah, and I sincerely think that. It's the overall thing. Okay, there was the little piece that I was kind of turning around when it happened, the piece in the spacecraft, but did I miss that in the book? I don't remember that.
But, no, it's a fictionalized account of what happened.
Exactly, but the thing that most people don't understand, and as a writer, you understand, I understand, that you have to make some compromises to get things to the screen.
And what part of the movie that you saw, Bert? Because I haven't yet seen the film.
What part?
That touched you, you know, most?
Well, that touched me most was the fact that, and this, I think, Tracy, is something that everybody involved in this movie can pat themselves on the back was, and that's the fact you could have left out the interior of the UFO, and the movie still would have been a great movie.
Thank you. I'm really glad to hear you say that, because that's how I feel as well.
I have to admit, personally also, that when I was seeing that, I was going, thank God, now we've got a UFO movie that is really going to do well at the box office because it's so well put together, and I was on the edge of my seat. There's just a tremendous amount of emotion, Don, to answer your question. One, as far as the individuals who are involved in all of this, the saying that they were being accused of murder, what they had to go through there, what the family was going through, and all of this stuff. And again, this part was maybe not something a lot of people who know about the case are expecting, but that doesn't make the movie not something to go see.
Great. Well, I appreciate that very, very much.
Jay, Bert, we do appreciate that. I've got to get rolling along here.
Get
we're almost at the half-hour break. You bet, and I've got other calls. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Guys.
Tracy, quick, before we go to the break, when did you first meet Travis?
I met him in 1985 on, believe it or not, Don, 10 years to the day after the incident. I met him on November 5th, 1985.
Would you say that he has greatly changed from that day until now? And how does he view all this?
Yes.
I'd like to be able to talk a little bit about the background of this, because so far we've talked about the movie.
Sure.
But this is about real people.
That's right, and he has changed a lot. He's changed a lot since I first met him. He was very guarded and very suspicious of anyone coming from the outside wanting to do his story when I first met him. And just in the 7 years I've known him, he has just become much more at ease with what's happened to him. He now takes an attitude of no longer having to challenge everyone who doesn't believe him. He accepts that there are some people who will never believe him. So he now sort of takes more of an attitude of, hey, I know this happened to me. If you can't accept that, that's not my problem. And I think that because of that, he's come out of his shell a lot. And it's helped him a lot on this publicity tour, because he's able to face questions he would have had a lot of trouble with 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay, we've got to take the break. And when we come back, Tracy, I would like to hear about some of the other people, because there is a tremendous story here, not only with Travis, but also with his brother-in-law. The fact that they were very close friends, and after this incident happened, I guess there was quite a split there.
That's the heart of the movie, Don.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And we're going to hit that when we come back. My guest this evening, Tracy Torme, screenwriter and co-producer of the new feature-length film on this fascinating phenomenon, Fire in the Sky. My name is Don Ecker. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network. And we have a couple of open lines, so we're going to take the break. If you'd like to speak to my guest this evening, give us a call if you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes at 5.
CRN, the cable radio network, presents this program for its entertainment value only as a service to our listeners. CRN does not endorse or object to any topics or views discussed in the program.
Hey, Tracy, we are back, and we have a call from Dave at, I guess that's at the Audio Video Clearinghouse.
That's right, Don and Mr. Torme, how are you?
Hi, Dave, how you doing?
Just great. Before we go any further, this is not a joke. Let me run this, so listen up, everybody, for those of you that don't know about Fire in the Sky. Here we go. This will be 1 minute, okay, Don?
Well, we got a lot to do here, Dave. What is it?
Well, I have the trailer from the film. Want me to pass on it or what?
I think that would be a good idea. Yeah, we've got a show to do. What can I say, Dave?
Well, actually, I wanted to talk to Mr. Torme. Mr. Torme, are you familiar with Mr. Meadows and Mr. Carr down there, Mr. Phillips down at Paramount?
Meadows, Carr, and Phillips, no, I can't say I am.
Well, they're in charge of motion picture promotions.
Because I'm working with most of the PR people, and I don't know that those names, but maybe they're in distribution or something like that.
Anyway, they were very kind to us. I had called them up when Fire in the Sky was first starting, and I asked Mr. Phillips and Mr. Meadows if we could, you know, get some posters for the movie and some T-shirts, and...
Did they help you out?
Oh, incredible.
Okay, good.
Incredible. So we're putting the trailer, the opening trailer, on all of our videotapes that we do.
Do you like the poster?
Oh, listen, people are knocking my doors down from here to Indianapolis to get more.
I wish I could say I designed it, but it's pretty nice. I've got a couple myself.
Well, guys, we don't have one, so Tracy, you know what your next job is. Get one out to us.
Don, I'll mail you a poster.
Okay, Dave, take care.
No, I had a question for Mr. Torme, but I definitely did want to thank Paramount very much for their kindness.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. You also, if I recall, Mr. Torme, also did something with the Intruders movie. Is that correct?
Yeah, I came in and rewrote that for them.
Right.
CBS.
With a number of different sci-fi and UFO movies you've worked on, especially the two UFO movies,
mm-hmm.
do you find that there's something in common in, like, all of these abduction cases, like the Intruders?
Sure.
And the Travis Walton, and what would you say that one underlying factor is?
Well, sure, but maybe what's more interesting about your question is there's a lot in common with all the abduction cases, but I don't think Travis's case is an abduction case. I think that it's more of a hit-and-run accident. I think it doesn't fit any of the other patterns as in the cases that were explored in Intruders. So my personal feeling is it was really a one-of-a-kind deal that doesn't fall into the parameters of most of the sort of Bud Hopkins type of abduction cases.
Because of so many witnesses, or what?
So many witnesses, gone for 5 days and 6 hours instead of a couple of hours. When he awakened, he was not paralyzed, he was not naked, he was not being experimented on medically. He has not had any experiences since then. He didn't seem to have any in childhood. He didn't come back with a lot of scars or anything. So I think all of those things break the mold and make this case unique.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call, Dave, and we're back now. Tracy, this story is not only a story about UFOs, but it's also a story about personal relationships. And I guess, as you stated earlier, this is the crux of this particular film. What was it that made this so fascinating and, I guess, so dramatic for purposes of the screen?
Well, Don, I think the heart of that question is the relationship between Travis and Mike Rogers, because Mike Rogers was his boyhood best friend and was the leader of this crew of woodsmen. And in a moment of absolute panic after Travis had been blasted by some kind of lightning-like bolt of light and flown through the air and landed dead as far as these guys were concerned, everyone screamed at Mike to hit the accelerator. And in that moment, when he did hit the accelerator, his life changed forever, and so did Travis's, and so did everyone's. And I was just fascinated by that because in a lot of ways, Mike Rogers is a great hero. And yet he became the pariah, you know, in this town where people thought he was a murderer or a liar or a coward or whatever. He had to go back to his own sister, who later became Travis's wife, and admit that he fled and left Travis. And the last time he'd seen Travis, Travis was lying there, and 10 minutes later, Travis was gone. So to me, again, you know, I was maybe a little unfair with your first caller this evening. I didn't mean to be harsh because he sounded like a really good guy, but the point I'm trying to get across is, that is what this movie is about. It is not about the special effects sequence on the ship, although I think people will like that. I hope they will. But it is about the human drama of what happens to people who see a UFO and are disbelieved just because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
But yet what we had basically when this actual incident occurred was a truck full of young men.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know how young men in their teens and early 20s are. They like to project the macho image. And suddenly they were confronted with something absolutely beyond the ken of anything in their experience. And then the forces of law and order stepped in.
Right.
And some of these kids got leaned on pretty hard, didn't they?
That's absolutely true. And, you know, very interesting. I mean, they were considered to be murderers by most of the law enforcement people. And they were, you know, some of these guys were devout Mormons. One in particular was pulled aside while they were searching for the body. And the cops really leaned on him and said, look, we know you're an honest guy, you're a choir boy, et cetera, et cetera. Where's the body? Where'd you chop it up? And where'd you hide it? Take us to it. And this was just tremendously, you know, disturbing to these guys that nobody would believe them. And again, that's what attracted me to this story much more than the UFO element in it did, because I just thought it's a fantastic human story, but it also has a bizarre twist, an interesting twist, which is the UFO angle.
Well, have they been able to put aside their differences and come back together, or is there still a little tension there?
No, there's still a little tension there. They drifted apart to the four winds right afterwards. And see, Bill Class would have you believe this was a hoax put together to get out of a logging contract.
Yes.
But what he ignores is the fact that a couple of these guys had just joined the crew 3 days before. They weren't even friends. So the idea that someone would subject themselves to a murder investigation, become pariahs, lose their job, and then get kicked out of town, just to pull off a hoax, it makes about as much sense as most of Class's stuff.
What about any of the other people in that area, Tracy? Was this an area that had sightings of anomalous objects?
Yes, very much so, Don. It's very much an area that has a lot of sightings like that, and it has your typical old Indian legends, too, about little people that dropped down from the sky and took children and women away and stuff like that. So it is a very mystical and strange area, and it has a lot of UFO sightings. And the actual location the film is set in is a big part of the movie.
Do you think that this will basically help purge Travis, or do you think that this is ultimately going to be more of a burden for him? Because what we're basically doing now, prior to this film being produced, sure, a lot of people had heard of the Travis Walton story, but nobody was really familiar with it to the point where we're basically going to be looking inside this guy's hip pocket. Do you think this is going to be detrimental to him?
No, I think it's a catharsis for him, Don. I think that he has to take the medicine a lot that doesn't taste too good to get to that point. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff on this tour, you know, we've done where a lot of people have treated him. Most people treat him very well, but occasionally someone will come out and treat him like a monster or a freak or a liar or whatever and thrust a microphone in his face and say, you know, why are you selling out and telling this hoax and taking all the money and running and all this stuff? And he's a very proud and very private person, so that part is tough for him. But I think coming out in the open with this and discussing it has been really good for him. I think he'd be the first one to agree with that, ultimately.
Okay, we're going to have to take another quick break, but hold on there, Tracy, and we'll be back. We have about 16 minutes left in the program. For you folks that are sitting out there and listening, my guest this evening is Tracy Torme, screenwriter and co-producer of the new film just being released on March the 12th, Fire in the Sky, The Travis Walton Experience. And if you would like to speak to my guest, you can reach us by calling, if you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes. We're back. Tracy, what do you think is the most enlightening thing of this entire experience? I mean, you've been involved in this for years. Do you think that you've come to any self-truths, any realization about the human experience or what, in fact, may be happening with these very strange encounters like this?
I think one of the things everyone takes from this story is the way that people will turn on certain individuals in a heartbeat if something that they are promulgating doesn't fit into their view of reality.
Do you think something as venal as human jealousy may be involved in this?
You know, almost every emotion is involved in it, Don. It's just, you know, jealousy was certainly probably part of it, too. But these poor guys really went through a hell of a lot. And, again, just from maybe the way that I approached the screenplay and approached the story, that was what I grabbed onto. The rest of it was sort of the icing on the cake. But I really was attracted and grabbed onto, hopefully, the turmoil that surrounded the men involved.
Okay, well, some of the people that are involved in this project, and we're talking about some pretty heavyweight talent in this area. We're talking about James Garner, the original TV Maverick.
Yeah.
We're talking about Robert Patrick, the fellow that was the T-1000 Terminator in Terminator 2. We're talking about D.B. Sweeney. We're talking about the kid, what was his name, Henry Thomas, that was in the original E.T., the extraterrestrial. How do these people see this particular story? Do they see this as just another job, or do they feel that there may be something there?
No, that was very interesting because many of the people came in as skeptics and said, we're going to do the movie, but we don't really believe Travis. And by the time the film was over, everyone was almost falling over themselves to defend Travis to the media and to talk about Travis because they all came to believe him. I don't think there was anybody who met him and worked on the film that didn't end up as a believer, just because the more time you spend around him and the more you study the facts. You know, Don, this is a case where all the evidence is on Travis's side. And then on the other side is the attitude of, well, these things don't happen, so it couldn't have. That's it. That's how the scales are balanced. I mean, every piece of solid evidence now is really in their favor. So I think, you know, in Robert Patrick's case also, he really got involved heavily in this, and he drove up to Snowflake and sat outside Travis's house and watched him for a while without Travis knowing it. And that was before he even read for the part. He just read the script, and he really felt attracted to it, so he drove all the way to Arizona and did this.
Well, if he would have walked up to the house and held out the photograph of a small boy and knocked on the door and said, do you know this boy? I mean, that would have been pretty freaking.
He's done that on the set, too, at enough times.
Okay, we have a call from John in Gainesville, Florida. Let me see. John, are you there? Oh, John's not there. Okay, we lost him. One other thing, Tracy, when something like this occurs, and we're talking about a case that initially received literally international exposure, there are many people that are Monday morning quarterbacks. You had mentioned Phil Klass earlier. I know I spoke to Phil several years ago about this very case, as a matter of fact, in Pensacola, Florida. And I mentioned him. I said, well, Phil, how do you explain the fact that all these people, after this case happened, before Walton returned, sat down and agreed to take a polygraph examination? And with the exception of one person, they all passed across the board.
Right.
And later on, I understand this other fellow, in fact, did pass.
He sure did.
A polygraph exam. And he basically had no real good reason, but he talked around it.
That's right. See, had the polygraphs turned against these guys, he'd be the first one to spout it as proof, not even as evidence, but as proof that it was a hoax, okay? If one guy had gone down, that's all he would need to say in his next book, is he'd say, that's it, it's a hoax, here's the proof, goodbye. But when they all pass, then the best thing to do is, let's just ignore it. And that's the way that these psychopath guys usually work. They're not interested in the truth. They're not really interested in confronting an unknown thing and really trying to solve it. They're interested in debunking it. And that's
well, you've been around many people in this field. You've been around people like Dr. Jacques Vallée, whom we consider at UFO Magazine to be one of the premier researchers presently active today. You've been around people at the Center for UFO Studies, some people that have some definite scientific background. But yet people from the PsyCop sector take a look at this and they are not even willing to examine the evidence to the extent to admit that something in fact may have happened.
It's true.
Regardless of whether it's real or not real,
right.
They refuse to look at it. And why do you think that is?
It's truly incredible because during my Star Trek days, we worked with JPL quite a bit, and I used to ask some of those guys at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, you know, about this. I'd bring the subject up gingerly. And I found that two things were always true. A, they had complete contempt for the subject in the sense of anywhere from outright contempt to mild contempt, as if I just brought up goblins or ghosts or something like that.
Or you walked in with something brown and smelly on your shoe.
Right. Or, and then the second thing I would always find out is that the more anti-UFO they were, the more ignorant of the subject they were. They just knew nothing about it. They would come up with all the same old things that Carl Sagan likes to trot out, like, there's no hard evidence, there's not one case that stands up, pilots don't see these things, astronomers don't, and all that stuff is just blatantly untrue.
Ah, but then I say au contraire. Now, I have, as a matter of fact, just 2 weeks ago, received a stack of original NASA photographs from the original negatives on the moon, Tracy. We, as a matter of fact, had a show on that very thing last week. And just sitting down, and I'll be the first person to admit I am in no way a photo analyst. However, I do recognize strange oddities when I see them. And I at least have enough finesse that I will take these to professional or even amateur astronomers to find out, well, am I seeing something more than what is there? And in these photographs, and we're talking about close to a dozen plus photographs, every one of them have extremely artificial looking strange oddities in these pictures. Things from that appear to be buildings to large, and I'm talking about extremely large pieces of equipment. And you just have to look at them under a glass. But yet the majority of astronomers will not even say, it's like Galileo's contemporaries refusing to look through his telescope.
Right. Well, every time we look back at a science of its period, you always have these loads of quotes about this isn't possible, that isn't possible, so therefore we're not interested. And then 50 years later, all of those people look like morons. That's exactly what's happening now. I mean, they have their own box-like view of the universe. And let's face something, Don, here. This field desperately needs good skeptics, okay? It desperately needs good skeptics. One of the reasons that I almost have an affection for Phil Klass is because at least he's doing some sort of investigation, no matter how pitiful it is. Okay?
Well, he's keeping some of the more fringe elements honest.
Right. However, I have found almost no good skeptics. I mean, the skeptics that get involved in this come in with an axe to grind, with an attitude of this cannot be happening, and therefore they don't come in with an open mind, because almost anyone who does has to come away believing there is solid evidence that something is going on.
Okay, now let's just for the sake of argument hypothesize that there is no doubt that there is strange aerial anomalies. Now, what is your speculation as to what these are? Now, people like Vallée are loath to put the moniker of ET on them. And there are many other people that look at this from different angles, from, for example, interdimensional beings, some looking at them as extraterrestrial. What do you think is behind this phenomenon?
Well, I think the best guess is extraterrestrial, but I do use the word guess with a capital G.
Because, well, as I said, hypothesis.
Yeah, because I really think no one really knows. I mean, even people who think they've been told by the aliens we're from this star system or here's where we come from or whatever, you know, there's a lot of theater involved in abductions. There's a lot of information that seems to come out from whoever these guys are that doesn't seem to be real accurate. Okay, they've shown people apocalyptic visions that, you know, 50 different apocalyptic visions of the way the world's going to end. So there's some theater going on, and I think it's really hard to say who they are, why they're here, what they want. I tend to lean towards sort of a nuts and bolts attitude. I tend to think that they are craft, that they're probably extraterrestrial, and that they are probably involved in some sort of genetic experimentation using human beings. That's, to me, the most logical thing I've heard and has the most evidence to support it. But as to whether they could be, you know, ultra-terrestrials from some other dimension, from the future, from, you know, from parallel...
Well, I don't know. I'm just a country boy, but it still comes out alien to me, regardless
right.
of where they're from.
But, you know, what I'm saying is anything is possible. I think that any of those explanations are within the realm of possibility.
Well, what about the idea that many of these encounters, these incidents, are a manipulation of a type? There was an excellent book. As a matter of fact, it just has been released by Avon in paperback. It should be out on the bookstores, on the shelves, in the next week or two, called The Gods of Eden, written by William Bromley. And we, as a matter of fact, did a book review on this book when it was in hardback 2 years ago. And Bromley took a look at the overall phenomenon, Tracy, going back literally thousands of years, and has made a really tremendous hypothesis that this, in fact, is a type of manipulation. Are you familiar with that?
No, it sounds really interesting, though.
Well, it's certainly something that you ought to check out, but a lot of his research, he credits receiving his inspiration originally from Zachariah Sitchin.
Well, I think that most of the manipulation going on that I'm aware of is very earthbound, and unfortunately this field is ripe for being manipulated, and I think a lot of people, as we speak, are being manipulated, and it's unfortunate.
You're talking about from intelligence sources?
Well, I tend to, you know, one place you and I maybe go a little bit differently is I don't believe in a big government conspiracy. I'm not saying you do, but I'm saying I tend to think that the people in the know are part of a very small group, and I think when they do disinformation, they just plant a seed, and then they let ufologists run with it, and by the time it goes coast to coast and comes back, the story has grown and grown and grown, and people spend a lot of time going in circles chasing false false things. So.
But yet, Tracy, you have to admit that there have been some cases that have come out in the last 5 years that, in fact, have shown strong governmental interest. And I'm speaking primarily, number one, of the admission by William Moore at the Las Vegas Mutual UFO Network Conference back in 1989, where he admitted being part of a disinformation operation that was launched against a civilian scientist.
Yeah, but launched by who?
OSI, according to Bill.
Yeah, I mean, there could be shadowy elements that sort of cross the lines between official military people and between more of a shadow government. I mean, I tend to believe more in the shadow government type of angle. I think that, and you know, OSI could be involved in a lot of things that could ultimately be about the stealth and other airplanes where they will send people off on false leads ufologically to keep them away from other things that are much more earthbound, if you know what I'm saying. So,
yes.
So I kind of tend to think that the problem with the government conspiracy angle is there's just not the amount of evidence, there's not the amount of leakage that there should be.
Have you read Jacques' new book, Forbidden Science?
Sure.
Okay, did you read recall the section on something he referred to as the Pinnacle Letter?
Yeah, that was very interesting, actually, yeah.
Okay, you know that we at UFO Magazine secured a copy of that letter through a source, and it is, Tracy, in the new issue of the magazine that just now is out on the bookstands. Now, basically, the crux of this particular letter is, in fact, that it was written by a very highly placed individual at the Battelle Memorial Institute, which was under governmental contract back in 1952. And they admitted to, at that point, and this is contrary to everything that has ever been known about UFOs and the government, admitted to having studied thousands of cases at that time. And as a research project, they were talking about frauding up a UFO sighting wave to find out what the public perception would be.
Interesting, yeah, very interesting.
Well, that certainly, to me, shows some government involvement.
Yeah, Don, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the government is completely uninvolved, but I'm just saying I do not believe Bill Clinton is sitting on the UFO secret and waiting for the right time to release it to the world. And you know, a lot of people do believe that.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been saying this going back to Jimmy Carter and before, that, you know, any day now the big news is going to be given.
Oh, sure.
I don't think the government per se is in the UFO business. I think it's more of an Oliver North type of group that's in the UFO business, if you know what I'm saying.
It's very possibly that if that's true, they're pretty highly placed and somebody is financing them. But, you know, then we have to take a look at what the overall defense budget is now, Tracy. $400 billion a year, with approximately 10% of that $40 billion allocated for black projects.
Yeah, you never know when Bolivia is going to attack, so we got to keep that defense budget high, right?
Oh, hey, absolutely. Bolivia, or perhaps even El Salvador.
Right.
There's no telling.
Yeah, sure. I think there's plenty of money in black projects that's probably going toward a group like this. But, you know, Don, look at that book by that guy Bloom, you know. To me, that book was just a muddled mess.
Total disinformation.
Exactly. Well, who's doing that and why?
Well, he had many contacts with folks within the National Security Agency.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a crossover. I mean, I think there are some people who may be with the NSA and other things who are also secretly involved with the type of group I'm hypothesizing. You know, I think it's not cut and defined, but I just think that that the real group at the core of this is probably not directly governmental, they're more indirectly governmental.
We're out of time. Thanks very much. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Don Ecker Live.
Well, Tracy, that was Larry telling us we're just about out of time.
I was going to say good impersonation there, Don.
No, that's the real thing. That's the real McCoy.
Kind of scared me a little bit there.
Tracy, quickly, we have about 45 seconds. What projects do you have coming up next?
Well, I'm doing a Western for HBO. That's a kind of a unique, almost post-apocalyptic Western, and something I created as a movie, and then hopefully it'll go to series, and then I'm talking about adapting a famous book, a horror novel called I Am Legend that Richard Matheson wrote that some people might know. And I'm doing something with Bob Dylan, the autobiography of Buddy Rich. We're both producers on it, and we're looking to get that launched somewhere.
Sounds exciting.
Thanks, Don.
Hey, look, I would like you to come back again and talk about our favorite subject.
Love to do it.
Okay. Hang on for just a minute, Tracy, and I'm going to be off the air. I wanted to speak to you.
Sure.
Hold on, and we'll be right back. Okay, that's it, folks, for another week. My name is Don Ecker. My guest next week is going to be Fred Beckman. If you don't know who he is, you're going to want to tune in, because he was back with Hynek and Vallée back in the days when things were really happening in the 60s. Upcoming weeks, we have many more exciting guests, and I'll tell you more about it in the weeks to come. But remember, keep your eyes into the sky, and don't forget, go out and check that movie next week coming out, March the 12th, Fire in the Sky, the Travis Walton Experience, and we'll see you next week. And here's the song. Come on, baby, don't be afraid. Baby, take my hand, don't be afraid.